This is me telling you this. The program is Media Network.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archive.
By shortwave and satellite, this is the Dutch International Service.
Media Network, the weekly communications magazine for shortwave listeners. Produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and glad you could join us. Let me start with advance warning of a slight frequency change affecting our English language broadcast to Asia as from Sunday, March the 25th. At 14.30 UTC, we'll be moving from 11.735 kHz, that's 25.56 metres, which we use now, to 11.740 kHz, that's 25.55 metres. Not very much, I know, but we expect interference on our present frequency if we don't move. And we'd be interested in reception reports on the new 11.740 kHz at 14.30 UTC, as from March the 25th, from listeners in Asia only. But everyone's welcome to listen to this.
Perspective.
And this is our feature examining the background to broadcasting. And today I'd like to highlight a producer's dilemma. What can you put into a programme that goes under the title of Media Network? Since we started the philosophy of a communications magazine back in 1980, our field of interest has expanded from what I would term pure DX tips, without any background as to why they happen to be interesting at the time we're broadcasting them. From time to time, we also deal with computers, not as a regular item, but when there appears to be a future overlap into the field of consumer communications. But such items prompt letters like this from Mukesh Tekwani, who's a regular listener in Bombay, India.
I must say I'm satisfied with the content of your programme in general, but I do get the feeling that it sometimes becomes too much Western-orientated, with too much emphasis on home computers and satellites. I wonder how many people in Asia can afford either a home computer or receiving equipment to track satellites. Why don't you produce a special programme for Asia and put out a different programme to other areas in which you can present all the news about home computers and satellites, etc.?
Point taken. I don't think the average listener anywhere can afford satellite receiving equipment, so the budget problem isn't simply confined to Africa or Asia. In fact, there's every indication that hobbyists in southern India and Sri Lanka, who've been experimenting with home reception of the new Indian TV satellite using ingenious homebrew materials, are probably more developed than the so-called industrialised West. At present, simply for budgetary and staff reasons, we can't put out a special edition of Media Network to Asia on a regular basis. To succeed, it has to be done properly, and that takes more planning than you might first imagine. Having said that, we do get a lot of letters from the Indian subcontinent asking for information about home computers and satellites. On the line from Sri Lanka is Victor Gunatilaka now. So, Victor, do you think we'd be better off dropping the receiver review items, bearing in mind that a large part of the audience can't afford such luxuries?
Well, Jonathan, I'd like to tell you, before I ever saw a communication receiver, I was very happy that I knew what a communication receiver is, and I'm sure we would be very, very ill-informed listeners if we just didn't have these receiver reviews. And I'd like to tell you, Jonathan, that Practical Wireless or some such magazine crossed the earth here now, and it's not every DXer who can afford one of those, and especially because they don't run receiver reviews in bulk. So please do keep up those very, very useful receiver reviews that you do. And I think most third world DXers and also average shortwave listeners will be very, very thankful for such reviews, Jonathan.
Victor, what about home computers there in Asia? Are they available?
Oh, well, Jonathan, home computers were something that we used to read, like these receiver reviews. But fortunately, here in Sri Lanka, over the last 3 or 4 years, the computer market has been opening up, and most commercial establishments are using big computers, of course. And I was quite thrilled to see the arrival of the first home computer, which is in the range of about $150 to $200. Frankly, I have not been able to put aside that cash to go in for one, but they are being used. So I would say that they are breaking into the local scene quietly, and probably in the future that will be something that we would see in most people's shacks with a little luck, I hope.
Documentaries on specific subjects such as jingles back in December or getting a job in international broadcasting 3 weeks ago seem to go down rather well. Sometimes we seem to trigger an interest in a different way. Mr. De Winter, I think the signature says, wrote us this letter from Lausanne in Switzerland.
You put on air this morning a programme telling the listener a bit about international broadcasting, supposedly telling people how stations recruit their staff. That in itself was of minor interest to most of us who are not trying to get jobs there. What it did do, and what we found interesting in the interviews, was the glimpse of the mentality of the various broadcasting organisations. I can now understand why many international broadcasts are designed to put people to sleep or insult their intelligence. It wasn't so much you told us, but we had it from the horse's mouth. Who do that lot think they're talking to? One cannot help wondering.
See what I mean? Remember, if you have a concise opinion on the way international broadcasting is developing, our column Perspective is open to you. Now, if I were to say to name a shortwave broadcasting station operating from Canada, you'd probably think of this. But Radio Canada International doesn't have a monopoly in illegal shortwave broadcasting from their country like we do at Radio Netherlands. Canada operates 7 low-power transmitters on a variety of frequencies in the 49-metre band. 2 of the stations belong to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. The other 5 are in private hands. The transmitters are simply a relay of various domestic programmes, but the power is somewhat limited. The most powerful is located in Toronto, with the call sign CFRX. But in fact, it's a 24-hour relay of the medium-wave station CFRB. Normally on this programme, we talk of a new transmitter with powers of 100 kilowatts or more. So when we heard that CFRX had just bought a new 1,000-watt shortwave transmitter, we were rather interested. What can you do with that low power against all the interference? Media Network reporter Steve Webster went to the CFRX transmitter building and asked the engineer, Bruce Dingwall, why they decided to invest in upgrading what must be a limited service.
I think it's a case of testing the waters because of the developments in shortwave in the United States. The commercial licenses that have come on the air down there are enough to make, I believe, the CFRB management, and I'm speaking only my opinions here, but I believe that they want to not only continue the license, but continue the service and see if the interest in shortwave around the world, and specifically with the Canadian listener, grows. We look at the service as one of being able to keep the Canadian from the Toronto area in touch with the Canadian news and the Canadian perspective of events and happenings when they travel in the United States, and thinking specifically of traveling down to the southern states and to Florida. By doing this, increasing the capabilities and reliability of CFRX, we hope that we are extending that service to more people. And since the new transmitter has gone on the air, I really think there has been a slight increase in the number of calls, and we anticipate that this will grow as the on-air personalities make the listening public more aware of CFRX and the fact that it's there.
Often we hear of a new shortwave broadcast facility coming on the air. People talk in terms of millions of dollars. How much did the station spend on this new transmitter?
Okay, this new transmitter was custom-built for us by Elcom Bauer in Sacramento, California, and it's the first of the 701B high-frequency series. This transmitter cost us about $16,000 American, and the results of the tests that I've conducted have been extremely encouraging from the viewpoint of higher modulation level to break through the noise of the shortwave band and reliability built in by a number of automatic reset circuits that were missing from the original transmitter.
So presumably this one will be more cost-efficient in the long run from the standpoint of upkeep and maintenance.
Oh yes, it had gotten to the point with the old transmitter, which incidentally is 43 years old, that we were spending 2 man-days a month to keep that transmitter on the air and to keep it performing properly. Beyond that, it was literally eating tubes, not an expensive tube, but it was very difficult to obtain, and sometimes we were losing them at a greater rate than we could obtain them, so it got to be a little nip and tuck.
How far do you get reception reports from? Are they limited to continental North America?
No, we very frequently get reception reports from the Scandinavian countries and Eastern Europe, and this pleases us immensely. The service, of course, is licensed for North America, and it is our intent to serve only the North American area. But as far as the shortwave listener is concerned, we will respond to any accurate reception report that they wish to submit on CFRX. From no matter where it comes from, we'd be pleased to hear from them.
Okay, I'm listening to CFRX for the first time. I'm hearing an announcer in English. Can I expect to hear CFRX give a station identification?
CFRX is, as you know, Steve, a simulcast of the programming that's on CFRB Toronto, Canada. But at approximately 20 minutes past the hour, there is an ID inserted automatically which identifies the radio station by call sign, by frequency, and by band.
You are tuned to CFRX Toronto, Canada, broadcasting in the 49-meter band on an assigned frequency of 6,070 kilohertz. CFRX broadcasts the regular program schedule of CFRB Toronto.
It is inserted automatically. The timer has frequently gotten a little out because of power failures, but we try to keep it from anywhere from 20 to 23 minutes past the hour. That's where they will hear the CFRX ID.
What about the old transmitter? Is that destined for the scrap heap or perhaps even a museum?
We really don't know what we're going to do with the old transmitter. We installed the new transmitter in a completely different area than we had anticipated, not taking the old transmitter out of service. Consequently, we have it to fall back on. We don't know that anybody would really want it, but what it does represent is one of the earliest forays into shortwave broadcasting as far as the North American continent and specifically Canada are concerned.
What is down the road? Will there be another transmitter, say, in 5 years with an even greater output power?
As you know, 1,000 watts is the maximum private license in Canada. We have anything from 10 watts to 1,000 watts on the air here in our 7 private shortwave services. To go beyond that, I really don't know the first step that we would take or whether it would be economically viable, because we don't know that anybody could build us a transmitter at a reasonable cost. Because CFRX does not sustain itself, it has no commercial sponsorship to sustain itself and relies only on public goodwill for its on-air performance.
Ship to shore, answer my call.
I think 1984 is going to be the year of broadcasting from the high seas. We've reported on the return of Radio Caroline, the start-stop situation with pop music station Laser 730, plans for Dutch-language Radio Paradise, and now, from the United States, comes not only word but rather clear indications that another organisation will be on the air in the foreseeable future from a ship in the North Sea. On Tuesday, we managed to talk to John England, who's project manager for Atlantic Charter Broadcasting Service in Texas, USA. And so I asked him what they're planning.
We're planning two different services to Western Europe, Jonathan. One of them is going to be a daytimer with popular music from 6 a.m. till 7 p.m. under the call sign WRLI, which will stand for Wonderful Radio London International. And the second one will be a nighttimer picking up from 7 o'clock and going through until 6 the next morning. And it will be featuring inspirational programs and contemporary gospel music. And it will go under the call sign ZFG, the Voice of the Free Gospel.
So will it be evangelical?
More inspirational and contemporary gospel than evangelical.
Does that mean that the people behind it have a religious message to make, or is it simply that you're offering airtime to people that do?
We will be offering airtime to people that do, primarily, because of the very makeup of the organization behind our broadcasting corporation.
The organization behind the two stations say they have a ship which they're calling the Four Freedoms. That name is based on the State of the Union address given by Franklin Roosevelt back on January the 6th, 1941. There he outlined four freedoms: the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and the freedom from fear.
Now, Radio London News tells you more, says it better.
Well, if you're feeling down,
goes according to plan, those jingles from the 60s will reappear on the European airways at 1501 UTC on August the 14th this year. That's exactly 17 years after the former Radio London closed down. But what sort of transmitter is being planned?
We're looking at the present time at a 50 kW medium wave transmitter and a 10 kW on shortwave.
Why shortwave?
For wider effectiveness, especially with regard to the gospel music program.
And where will the ship be anchored?
I suppose it will be in Radio Station Ship Alley, where they've always been, where Radio London's original ship was, and where the Caroline and Laser currently are.
You draw a parallel with Radio London of the old 60s. Does that mean that some people that were involved in those days are now involved in the new ship?
I have to be a politician here. I have been told to say I can neither confirm nor deny.
But there's a link as far as the station is concerned, because you're obviously using the old name.
There is a link as far as the station is concerned, and there certainly is a link as far as the originator of the station, the original Radio London station, is concerned. The person I'm talking about.
Tapes already exist of how the Voice of the Free Gospel station will sound like. Well, that jingle's the same music that was used by another pirate ship of the 60s, Britain Radio. Indeed, Britain is the main target area for this new ship, just like the other two at present in the North Sea. So what's the schedule between now and August?
What we're looking for, Jonathan, is heavy, serious construction to be completed by the first part of July. We're looking for the Four Freedoms to sail from a United States port in the early part of July to drop anchor in the North Sea the first part of August, the tests to be made then, and the Voice of the Free Gospel will be the first station on air. But other announcements will be made for WRLI so that the historic 1 minute past three broadcast can take place on August the 14th of 1984.
Well, to quote that current newscaster's cliché, time will tell. Now we turn to the topic of deliberate interference, and with me for the clandestine column is John Campbell.
The main moral this month is that it doesn't pay to be too successful, especially in the unofficial radio business, but even in the official radio business. Quite a number of successful broadcasts have attracted the attention of jamming stations of one kind or another lately. For example, some official source in Ireland has taken to jamming large parts of the FM or VHF broadcasting spectrum there to rub out the effects of the increasing number of FM pirates in Dublin, particularly the commercially successful ones like Radio Nova.
Well, indeed, John, we phoned a number of independent monitors in the Dublin area yesterday who observed that deliberate interference of two stations, Nova and Sunshine, is still continuing, the reason being that they're taking away national advertising from the legal RTE. Other local unofficial stations and all medium-wave frequencies are unaffected.
On the subject of official jamming, of official broadcasting, I've heard some rumours from Finland that there's been some recent jamming of Swedish FM and TV frequencies in the southwest of Finland. That's probably to stop the Swedish-speaking part of the population there from listening too much to broadcasting with a non-Finnish flavour. But I don't know if the jamming that I've heard about from Finland is just a matter of isolated experiments or whether it's part of some longer-term policy. I guess time will tell. Now, there's an even more intriguing report of jamming from the south of Yugoslavia, which follows some earlier news that there are people in politics in Yugoslavia who think that some of the programs that are produced and put out from the regular station in Pristina, which is close to the Albanian border and it's in an Albanian-speaking region, are thinly disguised pro-Albanian propaganda. Massimo Guardi tells me that there have been one or two instances of jamming of programs from Pristina, though, of course, we don't know if that's an official Albanian reaction or an official Yugoslavian action or a piece of private enterprise by a potential pirate operator who just thinks that the music that's broadcast from Pristina is too dull. I think that the first use of jamming was British in the late 1920s to block out signals from pirate commercial stations in northern France. These were attracting listeners away from the BBC. But it's another question entirely to ask when jamming was first used as some kind of political weapon. As far as I can tell, and I'd welcome any older examples if anyone can find them, this particular record is held by New Zealand, where the Postmaster General in the Conservative government tried to silence a very effective broadcaster for the other side on the station 1ZB during the national election campaign in 1935. For people who are interested, the broadcaster was a gentleman called Scrimgeour, or Uncle Scrim, from the time when he ran a children's program. And his entire career in radio is a very enjoyable story for anyone who prefers unofficial radio, or at least the unofficial approach to radio, to the other kind. Of course, I shouldn't miss the chance to say that Radio Netherlands programming combines the best of both approaches, or I wouldn't be talking to you here today. I can recommend a book on the subject of Uncle Scrim, even though it may be out of print now. It's called Scrim, Radio Rebel in Retrospect, and it was written by Les Edwards and published by Hodder and Stoughton in 1971. Well, I'd been thinking so much about jamming lately that I thought I'd been overthinking and hearing too much when the first thing that I came across on the traditional European pirate radio shortwave bands last Sunday was a station calling itself Radio Jammer International. But that was just an unfortunate defect of reception. In fact, when I could hear the station a bit more clearly, it was calling itself Radio Jammer International. It was on 7325 kilohertz, broadcasting between about 10 and 12 hours UTC. The name, I think, is in honor of some obscure pop singer. I'm not sure about that. But the station itself is more interesting as an example of a trend. There's some legislation coming up in the British system to make life a great deal harder for British pirate radio operators on all bands. I don't think it's been passed yet, but the fact that the legislation does look rather tough doesn't seem to have frightened off new stations or new potential stations from coming onto the air. In fact, quite the opposite. When you combine this with the observation that there are broadcasters in places like France and Switzerland, which haven't been noted for pirate shortwave radio before, also sneaking onto the air, then it makes for lively Sunday mornings in Europe.
Media Networks Book Review.
Well, let me stretch the title of this column to include pamphlets, because the first of a new series of newsletters arrived this week with the title of Clandestine Confidential, and I think it represents more of the trend to start up specialist publications for shortwave listeners. Edited by Jerry Dexter in the United States, it consists of four pages of news about political clandestine stations, in other words, stations using shortwave to grind a political axe in another country, not conventional hobby pirates. The Clandestine Confidential newsletter contains quite a bit of background as to the location, or supposed location, of some of the stations, and when they're to be heard. Addresses are also included where known. You'll have to pay for that information, though. $10 a year in North America, $13 elsewhere. And the address for further information is Jerry Dexter, Route 4, Box 110, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, and the zip code 53147, USA. Now, sitting opposite me is Bob Chaundy. What have you got?
Well, apart from this heavy cold, I've also got a paperback book called RTTY Today by David Ingram and published in the United States by Universal Electronics in Columbus, Ohio. The front cover claims that this book answers all amateur RTTY questions and covers all new teletype equipment. The 112 pages certainly do explain the principles of radio teletype very clearly and examine quite a few of the units available in North America. But we found the reviews to be more of a list of features than comments on how well the units perform against each other, and there's no indication of prices. In the home computer section, there's no detailed information as to what software is available to convert your home computer into a radio teletype station. We felt the book could have highlighted the problems you might encounter because of the radio frequency noise generated by many home computers, which seriously impair shortwave reception, and how they can be overcome. We found Chapter 8, which gives further sources of information, to lack a lot of detail. There's no index, so you can refer back to terms you've forgotten without having to wade through the book looking for what you want. Well, at $8.95 plus $1.75 for shipping and handling, we also found the book to be rather expensive. What's in the book is well written, but it doesn't go anywhere near the claim on the cover to answer all amateur RTTY questions, well, at least not the ones we have here in Europe.
Thanks, Bob. More books shortly, but now to media news. I've just noticed a report from the BBC Monitoring Service which has noted a news station in Asia, this time shouting towards Vietnam. Its name translates as Vietnamese Resistance Radio, and it claims that it's broadcasting from Base Camp No. 15 of the National Unified Front for the Liberation of Vietnam. Transmissions last for 60 minutes and have been heard at 02, 05, 09, 15 and 22 hours UTC on 7355 kHz. But it just shows you how history can repeat itself. If we turn the clock back 10 years, perhaps you'll remember this.
We came to liberation of Radio South Vietnam. South Vietnam liberation of Radio.
That was Liberation Radio, claiming to be in South Vietnam, but actually coming from Hanoi back in 1974. It had a Vietnamese service blasting away at the south on 10220 and 7416 kHz. This new clandestine station, with a similar name but with an anti-Hanoi message, is announcing 10300 and 7400 kHz. Well, is that a deliberate coincidence, I wonder? Well, on the end of the line now, to the World Radio TV Handbook editorial offices, we have Andy Sennett with more media news. What have you been hearing, Andy?
We've got the latest information from Mongolia, which seems to change its frequencies often. A collaborator in Japan has given us the latest schedule of English programmes, and at 1200 UTC, they're now using 9615 and 12015. That's 9615 and 12015. And at 1400 and 1445 UTC, they're on 7235 and 12015. 7235 and 12015. And those broadcasts are daily.
Okay, there's also been some moves down in southern Europe on the medium wave band.
Yes, indeed. A lot of publicity was given to the close down of Radio Andorra a few years ago, but surprisingly few people seem to have noticed that they've come back. They came back on the 12th of January, operating a continuous music format with no commercials, 16 hours a day on their old frequency of 702 kilohertz, 702. But the interesting thing is that in the meantime, that frequency had been occupied by a Catalan station in Barcelona, Radio Miramar. And obviously they can't both share the frequency that close together, so it'll be interesting to see who eventually moves.
Well, we listened to that frequency last night, and it was indeed quite a bit of a mess. What else have you got?
Well, this seems to be a good time of year to hear reasonable signals from WRNO in the USA, here in Europe. I heard them on 15420, which they use between 2000 and 2200 UTC. From March the 25th, which is a week on Sunday, Belgium, the BRT, will be using another new out-of-band frequency of 15550 to Africa between 17 and 2100 UTC. And AWR Europe are retiring their programmes again, and their DX programme on Sundays, in English, will now be at 0800 UTC, that's from March the 25th.
So that's 9670 kHz at 0800 hours UTC for the AWRDX programme on a Sunday.
That's right.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.